Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Michael Johnston, and today I have Dr. Teresa Gonzalez with me to discuss Building a Better Chicago, Race and Community Resistance to Urban Redevelopment, published by NYU Press this year, 2021. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gonzalez.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about the book.
Excellent. Gonzalez is a native of Mexican Chicago and strongly believes in the capacity of sociology to redress social injustices and inequalities. As a feminist and a woman of color urbanist, Dr. Gonzalez is rooted in community-engaged pedagogy and scholarship and strives toward a practice of reciprocity in research. Her work has appeared in the Journal of Urban Affairs and Social Problems in edited volumes and on Academic Minute. Building a Better Chicago shows how powerful redevelopment intermediaries influence local nonprofits and reshape the urban landscape to further marginalize communities of color. However, in this book, Gonzalez also shows how these communities, by using collective skepticism, advocate for themselves and demand accountability from the politicians and agencies in their midst. I'm glad to have you with me today, Dr. Gonzalez, and I guess can we start off with maybe how you came about this research and decided to pursue it a bit further?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for that great introduction. So as you mentioned, Michael, I grew up in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago. I'm from Mexican Chicago. And, you know, around the early 2000s started witnessing what I came to learn later were the initial influences of gentrification within my community. And was trying to make sense of what that means, what that looks like. Why is it that certain neighborhoods get developed and marketed in specific ways and others do not? And what happens to folks then when they become displaced? So that was kind of my first entree into really trying to understand this research. And that's what I explored when I went into graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley. My interest then started evolving as I began talking to more people and really, really exploring the ways that gentrification is linked to development writ large and how decisions sometimes that happen 20, 30 years in the past start to frame what communities look like, where development dollars are spent, but then also, you know, in response to that, how a variety of community organizations also respond, right, and how residents respond to the way these development decisions happen. So that was then really where the impetus of the book emerged, was trying to make sense of, all right, well, what does large-scale redevelopment look like in this city? What does it look like in two of the most impoverished communities across the city? And then how are residents responding to that and in kind of unique and interesting ways?
And your approach to this was actually going to the ground level, a Chicago style of research, if we may, although, you know, it's expanded beyond Chicago. But that's really where, you know, the Chicago style got its roots. And you went down and talked with the people in these neighborhoods, particularly two neighborhoods, right? Inglewood and
Little Village.
Little Village. Yes. Mm-hmm. Inglewood and Little Village. And yeah, could you talk a bit more about that approach and the value of that in the research that you did?
Yeah, so I'm trained as an ethnographer, and coming into the project, I was wrestling with doing, you know, ethnography versus just doing interviews, and decided I don't know how residents are understanding development happening in these spaces. And I don't want to assume, right, a whole lot of things, because this, you know, oftentimes in communities of color, a lot of researchers go in with a lot of assumptions. And I was trying to really, you know, minimize a lot of that. So I decided, all right, let me just start going into Little Village and Greater Inglewood and attending meetings and just talk to folks and kind of see what's happening, see how they're responding, and see how they're making sense of these local issues. And so one of the really great aspects of ethnography is that you get to not only hear, right, folks and how they talk about the world around them, but you also get to see them put those words to action. And so oftentimes people, like, it's not that people lie, it's that we do, and this is all of us, right? We engage in actions, we do certain things, and then we rationalize them or we make sense of them. And however we're talking about those actions doesn't always line up. So the reason I say this is because a lot of what I was hearing, and this was at, I went to so many community meetings. This was at community meetings and conversations with community organizers and conversations with activists and conversations with residents, journalists, you know, people at the city, was that the folks really had a lack of trust. They were not trusting each other. Organizations could not get things done because of this lack of trust. And this is why these neighborhoods were in such decline and experiencing so many social issues, was because of this rampant mistrust in their communities. So this is what I'm hearing. Yet what I'm seeing are vast mobilizations of residents coming out to community meetings, of being engaged, of asking questions of their elected officials, of people at the county level, of the activists and community organizers in their midst. I'm seeing community organizations working together, even if they don't always get along, right? I'm seeing them working together on particular initiatives. I'm seeing them holding each other accountable, holding the city accountable. And so this is where then I started asking myself, okay, well, what if all of these people are saying they don't trust each other? How the heck are they able to get anything done? Right? Because we tend to think of mistrust as then leading to a total breakdown in a communication, right? I don't want to deal with that person. Maybe I become apathetic. You know, maybe I disengage. We're here. Maybe I was like, well, maybe they don't trust each other. I don't know, but they're still getting things done. So what really is going on? And so that was really then able to inform a lot of the interviews that I had subsequently. So part of the way that I approach my work, and this is what I learned just kind of figuring stuff out as a graduate student, and then have really come to kind of honor giving research that space, is that if you wait kind of a period of time just to observe and engage and see what's happening within any given space, not only does it create rapport, which is what, right, one should be doing with research and what the folks are working with, but it also gives you a greater insight to processes that are happening on the ground, right? It gives you greater insight into all of these social relationships, and it allows you to ask deeper questions. When you're then, right, sitting down to have these hour, 2 hour, 3 hour long interviews, it allows you to ask deeper follow-up. So when folks would then tell me in an interview, well, nobody trusts each other, I could then say, well, but then why are you all working together? Right? Why is it then that you're able to get things done? And then they would say, oh, well, because of this, because of that. So this is where I think is the real beauty and importance of ethnography that not everyone always recognizes.
Yeah, and one of the one great quote that I pulled directly from your book when reading it is that you state organizations are not free-floating islands of rationality. So I think maybe you touched on that when you said you went down to hear the stories from the people who are living their everyday life, getting to hear what they say in their interviews, but then also starting to understand where this rationality, these truths for them, came from beyond what they simply say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that we tend to think about organizations and people as separate entities. And in many ways, they are, right? They absolutely are. Like, organizations are not people, regardless of what certain folks might think. But because we think of them separately, we oftentimes think they operate in, like, right, these little islands. They're in a vacuum and they're not influenced by local culture that's around them. And part of what I'm trying to show in the book is that organizations exist in fields, right? Other scholars have argued this. They exist in fields and they are influenced by the other organizations in their midst, and they're oftentimes constrained in the decisions that they can make. But they're also influenced by the people within their organizations, right? And constrained in some of those ways also. So when we think about how organizations operate, how people operate, we have to not, yes, they're different, but socialization happens similarly, right? Networking happens similarly. It's just that the goals and the efforts are different, right?
And then another piece of this is this idea of collective skepticism. And you kept making reference to that in your earlier statement about people having disbelief and people not trusting one another, but progress still being able to be made across organizations that were working together. What is this collective skepticism that you mentioned?
Yeah, so this, just to give you some background about where it came from. So I developed this term literally sitting, this is the importance of podcasts, sitting in my car driving, and I was listening to a podcast on just Robert Merton's description of organized skepticism. And this is, you know, he talks about when we're thinking about scientific communities and their responsibilities to society, we have to understand, right, that scientific claims should be subjected to heightened scrutiny. And also that sciences and scientists' ability to uncover truth, but also their search for uncovering truth, allows them to disrupt power structures, right? So this really struck me as I was driving, and I started then making connections between Merton's discussion of scientists in the 1940s to then my right interactions with these grassroots organizers that I'm working with in Chicago. So that's kind of like where I came up with the term, but then what does it actually mean? So this is a strategic collective mistrust that's used, right, as it's really used, and in this case, to task development elites. So when we're thinking about city hall, planners, developers, what have you. So it really tasks them to clearly outline what their development agendas are and how those agendas are going to support and include marginalized populations, particularly low-income communities of color. And when we're thinking about collective skepticism, I really want to highlight the importance that it is both collective and it is strategic, right? So this is in no way an apathetic mistrust where people are just say, oh, you know, they throw up their hands and they disengage, or they become really angry and they feel disempowered, right? This is not that. It's a strategic undertaking by groups of people, right? It's collective, who recognize the possibility of mutual benefits, right? There can be a mutual benefit when you work with politicians, other city power holders, technocrats, what have you. So when we think about then how do folks use collective skepticism, it's really an understanding that, you know, if we're going to engage with these power holders, it's because we're going to engage with them on our terms, and we're fully understanding that trust within these networks is situated within a system of power. And because of that, we're going to recognize that our goals may be different from the goals, right, of these urban elites. It may be different from the goals of other community-based organizations in our neighborhoods, right? But we're going to approach this in a way that even if we have some skepticism, even if we have some mistrust that's rooted in all kinds of histories of dispossession and trauma, we know that we can gain some level of benefit and we can achieve some kind of goals that are important to us in our communities. And so because of that, we're going to find ways to work together.
So trust is one important component that you mentioned, but another one would be social capital, right? Because they would have to be able to have access to a certain population to really start to gain motion and gain traction in the efforts that they're putting forth to create change.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other thing to think about social capital, in the same way, and this happens with trust also, is that in our society, we tend to think that these are both really great, overly good things. And we only focus on the positive aspects of both social capital and trust, which this is not to say that we don't, they're not important. They absolutely are. Trust is very important to all kinds of social relationships. So is social capital. But what I'm trying to show in the book and what I argue is that we need to be critical of these terms and really kind of see, all right, but how is it that social capital, and other scholars have pointed this out too, right? Social capital can also consolidate power and create barriers of exclusion, right? And how is it that trust is also serving to also consolidate power and create barriers of inclusion? And so in starting to critique these terms, starting to kind of say, all right, what might be this insidious underbelly that we tend to ignore? Might we take a step back and instead of saying, okay, we need to build trust, we need to build social capital, might it make more sense for us to say, let's use collective skepticism as a concept and a tool for thinking about how we can build coalitions that actually ensure a more socially just city, that aren't just about building trust, but are actually about transforming, right, what these cities look like for marginalized populations.
Which then leads us to different models and how to build communities, revitalized, because the basis of this was on gentrification of these Chicago neighborhoods, also mm-hmm. also known as urban redevelopment, and the resistance that communities have, particularly when urban redevelopment takes place in the vision of people who have large amounts of clout and are in power, but not redesigning it in the image of the people who already live there, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's true.
Yes. And these models that you wrote about were growth-based asset model and the asset-based model of redevelopment. Not redevelopment, excuse me, of development. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to learn a little bit more about these two different models.
Yeah, of course. So we can understand the growth-based model as really primarily a place-based kind of initiative, right? So what that means is that it really focuses on increasing either a city or a neighborhood or a town's wealth through a variety of mechanisms. So this might include tax subsidies to keep or attract businesses, various different beautification efforts, you know, greening activities, and then also attempts to really try and attract a higher earning worker. And that's key to this model. So the model really focuses exclusively on physical development, that's the place-based component, but then also attracting or retaining these high-salaried workers who ultimately can increase the local tax base and then the city coffers, right, for the local city base. In this growth-based model, there really isn't a focus on developing the skills of residents or increasing resident ownership of their communities. So what can end up happening is that because it's only focused on like on growing local wealth, on focusing on development to increase that local wealth, lower income residents are often displaced in the model. So in Chicago, many cities is contending with rising property values, and there's few mechanisms in place that will ensure residents aren't displaced, right? And then when we think about the asset-based model, it emerges kind of a response to this growth-based model. And there's a variety of different kinds of development initiatives that fall within it, but it's both a people and a place-based approach. So it focuses more on identifying and developing what we consider the assets, skills, and gifts of both physical landscapes and structures. So like the buildings, the streets, the kind of framework of the city, town, or neighborhood, but also the people who live in the community. Right. So it attempts to increase residents' access to their wealth, but also their ownership of their communities. And then because of that, theoretically, it should not lead to gentrification or displacement. Now, part of what I say in the book is that, and this is true, right? Most development initiatives don't follow, like they're not solely a growth-based model or they're not solely an asset-based model. They may be a combination. It may be, you know, something that's new than emerging. But just to give you an example of how this might look on the ground. So as I mentioned, my home community of Pilsen is gentrifying. It's kind of started gentrifying in the early 2000s, stopped, and now it's like full force again. So as a response to this, residents came together to implement a land use committee. And they were tasked with ensuring that any new developments would require 20% affordability rate, right? So any new developments in this, it was like a condo kind of building, any of those new any of the new units would require 20% affordability. So on the surface, it seems this is a great asset-based approach, right? You're ensuring there's some retaining of affordability for the community. We have a land use committee in place who are going to oversee this. It sounds wonderful. In practice, however, what was considered affordable ended up being at the high end, if not way above, community member salaries. So they use county level median income data, not neighborhood level. So there was a new development that occurred on 18th Street around 2009. It was slated to be 18th Street's kind of the main small business thoroughfare that cuts through the entire neighborhood. And it was slated to be built on one of the empty lots there. And when I went in to inquire, kind of like, how does this work? You know, how does one access the affordable units? I was told that realistically, and this was told to me by the nonprofit running it, that realistically, you would need a minimum income for a single person of $50,000 to even be able to get into any of the units. And most household incomes in the neighborhood at the time, the household incomes, not individual, were $35,000. So this already, right, cuts out this affordable building from even being, right, affordable to folks in the neighborhood. It becomes affordable for other folks. Also, so we have kind of that issue. The other one was that most of the people on the land use committee were appointed by the local alderman, and he wanted them to rubber stamp any developments that either he or the mayor's office gave the green light to. So if it had an affordability rate or not, he didn't care. If he said he wanted it to be built, then they would just rubber stamp it and move it along because they didn't want to disrupt that relationship with the alderman. So this is how an attempt even to kind of, you know, institute some level of asset-based development into an initiative or into a community can get superseded by that growth-based model, because at the end of the day, it is always about increasing, you know, the price of land and attracting those higher income workers.
And is also a great example of how social capital and trust can also result in horrible things.
Yes, absolutely.
So one of the things that you saw in Chicago at the ground level is you saw a sign that read "Building a New Chicago." The skeptical side of me makes me wonder who Chicago was really being built. Is this another example of your experience in Pilsner and the gentrification there, potentially also occurring in Greater Englewood and also Little Village?
Yes, this is a really excellent question. thank you for asking it. As soon as you asked it, I had the image of one of the billboards in my head. So I oftentimes wonder the same thing, and I wonder every time I go back to the city. So much of Chicago is gentrifying, and so many residents in communities of color are terrified of their communities gentrifying. I heard this consistently, not only in Pilsen, but in Little Village, in Greater Englewood, and elsewhere, that residents and activists were trying to find ways to prevent gentrification or to kind of sidestep it a little bit, or to ensure that it was just a little bit of gentrification and not full gentrification, because they were so worried. Even with that, though, even with housing prices and property taxes in a lot of areas increasing, this is also a city with really deep activist roots. And I was just back in Chicago in May to visit my mom after not being there for 2 years because of COVID. And I was really struck by, even with all of this, the rising housing prices, right, the efforts that are, you know, these anti-poverty efforts that are happening in the city, even with all of that, this is still very much a Black and brown city. And this is really, really credited to the amazing work of local activists across the city to ensure that power holders don't displace residents of color, that communities of color are represented in the cultural landscape, and that, you know, a variety of different kind of folks, regardless of socioeconomic background, regardless of race, regardless, right, of ethnicity, are able to still live and thrive in that city. So when we were there, for instance, on Michigan Avenue, this is the large kind of like upscale shopping district in the city along the lakefront. There was a large Black Lives Matter mural just indicating, right, the city's commitment and also residents' commitment to, right, trying to create a more socially just space. And there's also other efforts across the city to highlight this diversity. However, right, this representation also happens right alongside continued support of policies and actions that disenfranchise and terrorize communities of color. And the city, you know, it's such a complicated place, but so many folks within Black and Brown Chicago really refuse to be disempowered, and they refuse to be displaced, and they continue to do the work to create that more socially just city. And so when I see these billboards, even though I do also get that level of skepticism and that critique, I'm also filled with a level of hope because I know so many people are on the ground doing this really important work.
Yes, and even the people in this that you observed and interviewed in this for this book, for this research, had a desire for trust, but that also resulted in greater mistrust among the people who represented a variety of organizations as well as these two neighborhoods, correct?
Yep, that's true. Yeah.
And then this mistrust contributed to skepticism, which then results in a failure of reciprocity among each other, which is what's necessary to create change. So is that correct?
Yeah, I mean that could, and it did happen in many of the neighborhoods and with some of the initiatives. There were, you know, just feelings of frustration, right? Like, these are shady people. Why am I going to keep working with them?
And it was interesting because you differentiated, you studied two different neighborhoods and mm-hmm. they weren't one for one equal. They had some similarities, Greater Englewood and Little Village. I guess what were some of the main differences that you saw between these two communities?
Yeah, so just to give a little bit of background, so Greater Englewood it's comprised of Englewood and West Englewood. I combine them as one community because residents referred to them as one community. So I didn't see any reason in, you know, only focusing on one and not the other. So Greater Englewood is predominantly African American. It's politically fractured. So the way the city of Chicago works is they have aldermanic representation with one alderman, you know, kind of the political representative of one particular ward. And there's 50 of these wards across the city. Most neighborhoods fall into one, at most two wards. Greater Englewood, and then there's another neighborhood on the south side as well, is kind of fractured into these six different wards. So what that means is that there's no one political or two political representatives who are in charge of ensuring resources get funneled into this community. It's considered one of the most violent communities in the city. It's, you know, oftentimes when folks discuss violent acts happening in the city, they're oftentimes referencing Greater Englewood or highlighting actions that have happened within Greater Englewood. It's also a space that has experienced deep levels of disinvestment from the city. So there were over 5,000 vacant and abandoned lots that were owned by the city just within the community. What that looks like is that when you go into the neighborhood, it's very empty because there's so many abandoned lots. You feel that emptiness as you enter, to the point where I would drive through during rush hour and there would be very few cars on the street. One can drive from one end of the neighborhood to the next without really having to stop much, where anywhere else in the city, you're sitting for 3 hours in rush hour. You could also, if you walk down a block, there may be only one or two homes that are occupied. Others are boarded up or they've been knocked down and it's just an overgrown kind of empty lot. So it has experienced various levels of disinvestment from the city. They closed, I think, around 10 schools over the past 13 years within the community because of this loss of population and because, you know, of underperformance and all of these reasons they give. So that's kind of, you know, just to give you a sense of Greater Englewood. And then Little Village is another neighborhood that's considered, you know, the second most violent neighborhood in the city compared to Englewood. It's predominantly Mexican-American and Mexican immigrant. It's unlike Englewood, it's very densely populated. If you go down the main thoroughfares, 26th Street, regardless of the time of day, you're going to be stuck in traffic for quite a while because it's so densely populated and there aren't really a lot of major streets that run through it. It's, as I mentioned, experiences high levels of violence. It has low rates of education levels, similar to Greater Inglewood. Also, high poverty rates, similar to Inglewood. Unlike Inglewood, it's mostly within one ward, although parts of it are within a second and very tiny parts are within a third. And what that means is that a lot more resources get funneled into the community. What happens in Inglewood is that sometimes resources get funneled in and they get funneled out for a variety of reasons. We see some of that happening in Little Village, but not to the extent. Both Little Village and Inglewood are considered on the south side, but Inglewood is more deeper south along the east side, closer to the lake, and Little Village is more west in more of an industrial area. This is home to a lot of the highways. There have been a lot of large-scale industry that's either located or relocated there. So, yeah.
And the reason I bring this up is because how the city is designed and the population who lives there, I think, has an impact on what organized skepticism looks like. Is that right? Or at least did you see much of that when you were moving back and forth between the two communities?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So collective skepticism and Greater Inglewood happened more between, you know, there was much more of a willingness of local activists and residents to work with City Hall and with city officials. There was also a greater openness. So for instance, when I started doing field work, I began first in Greater Inglewood because I thought it would be harder and I thought it would take me more time because I'm, you know, a racial outsider. I hadn't really spent much time at all in Inglewood, Greater Inglewood prior to starting research. So I just assumed this is going to take me a lot more time. And folks there were a lot more open and welcoming. Not to say they weren't skeptical of me. Like, I don't want to give like this, you know, rosy picture. No, they absolutely, as they should, right, held me accountable also. But they were much more willing to network and to, you know, work with folks to try and get their goals realized. In Little Village, it was a slightly different story. Again, I assumed it would be much easier. It was because I'm a racial insider. We first lived in Little Village when I was a baby and before we moved to Pilsen. Little Village is right next to Pilsen, right? Like I would walk back and forth to see friends growing up. So I'm very comfortable with the community. I know the neighborhood. I can walk around it without getting lost. But it was, again, understandably so, activists and residents and community organizers were much more suspicious of the work that I was doing, but also of other outsiders as well who would come in. Because to their credit, they wanted to ensure that they were limiting exploitation of the community. They wanted to ensure that whatever partnerships, whatever networks they were developing, whatever people they were agreeing to work with, that there would absolutely be some level of mutual benefit. Now, this was the same case in Greater Inglewood, but there was just a different level of openness there to those relationships. Because I also saw people who would come in but not be willing to do the work, and then folks would just stop talking to them and they would kind of go away. Whereas in Little Village, there was more of a process of entering into that space and engaging in conversation. But then once you were in, right, then they would start being a little bit more open with you. So there was that aspect to it. But in terms of working with the city, and with other organizations, both, you know, with local nonprofits that I worked with and grassroots organizations that I worked with, they equally engaged in collective skepticism in similar ways, right? They equally approached this as very pragmatically, how are we going to use these relationships to realize certain goals, whether that goal is to promote our organization and attract more political clout and ensure that we can be decision makers at the city level, or if that goal is to ensure, right, certain development goals for our residents, certain initiatives that will address environmental racism, for example, certain initiatives that will build local wealth, for example. So as long as those relationships help to meet their goals, they were willing to enter into them. In some cases, a little bit more, you know, engaging with collective skepticism. In other cases, just fully embracing those relationships because, you know, aligning yourself with power comes with all kinds of lovely things, right?
Yeah. And so situational trust is what you're referring to here, not just fully engage in trust and saying no matter what, it depends on the situation at hand.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So kind of really thinking through like what am I going to get out of this? Is this important for me to trust in this particular situation? And that doesn't necessarily mean in 5 minutes I'm going to still trust you, right? It's just this situation requires it, and we'll see from there.
And then these two words, several other words, I'm sure, in Chicago also have these, but you wrote a bit about the new community programs and the local initiative support corporation. What are these things? What do they represent for the wards in Chicago?
Yeah, so the Local Initiative Support Corporation, it's a national redevelopment intermediary, which basically means that they operate as a go-between between public and private funders and community organizations to help realize community-based redevelopment. And they've been around since the late 70s. They are, you know, have funding from the Ford Foundation. They operate in, I think, 45 states across the U.S. So they have really emerged as a redevelopment expert within the development kind of field. And then the New Communities Program was a partnership with the Local Initiative Support Corporation. They also go by LISC, the City of Chicago, and the MacArthur Foundation. So the MacArthur Foundation is like this big philanthropic organization that, you know, they fund the MacArthur Genius Grants and like all of these other initiatives that mainly are Chicago-based, but they also do a lot of other stuff nationally as it relates to issues of social justice primarily. So this was this partnership that kind of emerged in the late 90s to rethink how is development going to operate in the city? How can we target resources into some of the most disadvantaged communities in the city and try to spur some level of redevelopment? And so that's where we then get the New Communities Program. So the New Communities Program was this 10-year initiative, started in around 2002, ended around the end of 2012, that had an initial $50 million investment that ballooned to over $900 million, targeting 16 communities of color across the city, the north side, west side, south side, what have you, to then really say, how can we tap into local nonprofits, train them, funnel resources into those nonprofits and then the communities to really spur resident-inspired, resident-led redevelopment.
So in an ideal, it's sort of an new community programs as well as this, as well as LISC serve as an intermediary between developers, the local government, and the people who live in these communities, along with the organizations that are located there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there somewhat of an illusion in this partnership that is created by the New Community Programs and Local Initiative Support Corporation in some of the cases?
Yes, absolutely. So what ends up happening? So the thing to keep in mind is that the New Communities Program, it used a lot of language of building deep relationships of trust. It was very much rooted in theories of social capital. For, you know, building these relationships with nonprofits and the city and really creating a coordinated effort to address long-term, right, social inequality. Sounds wonderful. And to their credit, they did do a lot. I don't want to dismiss the really great work they did. They did do a lot of really great work, particularly around building those relationships. And a lot of the language that they used really resonated with and drew on kind of these asset-based models of redevelopment. But part of what happened is that because they were an intermediary, because they're this go-between all these entities, they didn't want to upset anybody and that was part of this relationship. So that means, you know, if the city wants to continue kind of engaging in what ends up being very racist and classist policies, right, that continue to disenfranchise African-American, Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, and what have you populations in the city, and they are against advocacy work or they're against certain kinds of development in these neighborhoods, LISC was very constrained in that they didn't want to upset that relationship and they truly believed in their model. And so they would discourage, you know, the nonprofits they worked with in their networks from really challenging a lot of things or from engaging in activist work. They did not engage in any activist or advocacy work. That they were very upfront. We are not an active advocacy organization. We are a development organization, which is fine, right? That's kind of their goal, and that makes sense. But then to also pass on, you know, messages to the nonprofits that, like, well, if you want to pursue that, we can't help you because it's going to disrupt this relationship with our friends at City Hall or with the foundation, or, you know, the City Hall or the foundation isn't too excited about, or whatever, any of their other funders aren't excited about certain initiatives. So we kind of have to move on. Even if that initiative is successful, even if residents were very excited about the initiative, even if it was a really, you know, well thought out development project that would bring a lot of resources to the community, they were very constrained. And then there was also this expectation that because they're the intermediary, they kind of operate in the background, which then means that the nonprofits that are working with them end up taking all the fall if anything goes wrong. So they're advocating for these relationships of trust, for building what they call deep relationships of trust, but they were unwilling to make themselves as vulnerable in that relationship as they expected these nonprofit organizations to make themselves. And they were unwilling to really budge on questioning and challenging some of these decisions coming out of City Hall that didn't really, you know, support this effort to address long-term social inequality in the city.
And sometimes the developers as well as City Hall ended up benefiting monetarily more than what the nonprofit organizations did. Was that one of your findings?
In some cases, but not necessarily. So again, right, this is where I think the New Communities Program did do a good job of connecting folks to these networks. So what we see happening with many of the nonprofits that worked with the New Communities Programs, the nonprofits themselves not only received access to political leaders and decision makers in the city, they also gained access to other power networks that meant that they were considered initially or only on any new kind of funding dollars that came through. They were able to access a lot more grant money than previously. They were able to grow their organizations, experience some level of further professional development and what have you, you know, invited to do things at the city level, not just at the neighborhood level. So it did, you know, pull them into this broader network of governance that was happening at the city, more so than like that was only for the nonprofits in the network, though. That was not extended to nonprofits outside of the network, right?
And the importance of City Hall is part of this political machine that exists in Little Village and Greater Englewood, though. And the political machine, I think, is the power that the alderman has, but not so much the alderman, but also, you know, the mayor of the city and what is expected of the alderman to make things happen within their ward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how has it streamlined the organization, which resulted in secondary agencies and residents of the communities seeing fewer overall resources available to contribute back to their community? How has this relationship impacted the way in which these localities work in order to create progress in their cities?
Yeah, so like many places, Chicago is a complicated city, and currently it's in a moment of transition. So under Mayor Daley, which is this New Communities Program emerged under kind of the end of Mayor Daley, the second's long term as mayor. So under him, local representatives, which as you mentioned, Ray, in Chicago are called aldermen, they were primarily beholden to the mayor's office. So that meant that they wouldn't make decisions that went against Daley's wishes. So in Little Village, this meant that certain projects like building a new park were discouraged. And then in Greater Englewood, which I mentioned is fractured along these six lines, this meant that some projects were pushed through without community input, and then they ended up failing. And then under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who was the mayor after Daley, we saw the impacts of that machine in covering up the murder of Laquan McDonald, right? So there have been attempts to disrupt this machine, and there have been attempts to try and get new voices at the table who can start making decisions, but it's going to be a really, really long process. Both Little Village and Greater Englewood, like much of Chicago, again, this goes back to that activist history. They house a number of local community-based and grassroots organizations. So in Little Village, the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, or Alvejo, they're an environmental justice-oriented organization. They took on the task during this time to kind of address some of this like machine politicking, right, of pushing for the remediation of a Superfund site and ensuring that contaminated homes were fixed. And then they ensured that a much-needed park that residents wanted was built on this site after remediation. And then in Greater Englewood, the Resident Association of Greater Englewood, which is, it was at the time, this volunteer-only kind of strong group of anywhere between, you know, 60 to 70 residents at a time with five core organizers. So they were really instrumental in building local Black wealth through a lot of different initiatives. And in the book, I highlight their work on the Large Lot Program, which was a program that basically meant any of the homeowners in Greater Englewood could buy any vacant lot on their block for a dollar. So as I mentioned previously, Greater Englewood has had over 5,000 city-owned vacant lots. There were more vacant lots that were privately owned, but city-owned 5,000. This initiative that Rage helped push through and help lead meant that if you owned a home on a block and you saw, you know, an empty lot across the street or down the street, you could then buy it for a dollar and it's yours to do whatever you want. 15 years, you have to hold. 5 years? I think it's 5 years, not 15. You have to hold on to it. And then you can sell it at the end. And whatever you sell it for, you get to keep. The city and then the nonprofit that worked in the, with the New Communities Program, they continued to provide workshops on ways to kind of creatively redevelop those lots. So these were ways that local nonprofits, residents, and grassroots organizations were recognizing how the machine was limiting resources to their communities and saying, all right, we're going to disrupt this in these ways, either by working with the city to get something pushed through or doing a whole lot of community organizing to try and ensure, right, residents' desires are upheld.
Well, and allowing individuals from the community to build up their community where there might be greater trust available and buy-in, as compared to a developer coming into the community who doesn't have the same level of buy-in from members in those neighborhoods.
Absolutely. This is exactly what it is. Yes.
So a couple concepts that popped up in your book were poverty pimping and keeping it real. You mentioned a bit about Levejo. However, Rage was also another community organization, I think, that played a strong role in the community. So I guess, what is poverty pimping?
Yeah, so poverty pimping, this is when organizations, and we see commercials for some of these organizations, right? They use the poor basically to get money. So they typically use stereotypical images of the poor as violent or unruly or in somehow need of saving from themselves. And it situates the organization as the savior of these poor victims. As I say in the book, one community member, you know, said to me that if there weren't any problems, there wouldn't be any grant money, right, for these programs to exist. And so poverty pimps really kind of own that statement, and they can at times overinflate the social issues that are occurring, right? That they are the ones who can solve these. There are all these social issues and they are the ones who can solve them. So they need money in order to get those social issues solved. So in essence, right, it's a poverty pimp's advantage to continue highlighting harmful stereotypes of the poor and to continue pathologizing the poor because that ensures that their organizations are sustained. And then when we think about Alvejo and Rage. So what I found in the book is that organizations like Alvejo, who's the environmental organization, and then Rage, which was the resident-led organization, but then also another organization I talk about is Sustainable Englewood. So they didn't, right? They were very critical of poverty pimps. They were also critical of another kind of approach called keeping it real, which was almost a response to poverty pimping, right? So keeping it real is, it takes asset-based community development to like the extreme and says, community members must be involved in all decisions, and, you know, all solutions to local issues must only be found in the neighborhood. So they were critical of both of these models and were really a lot more pragmatic. So they used their networks. Again, they were very smart about tapping into networks, finding out who could help them solve these issues to ensure that their local-led initiatives were successful. So we see this in the case of Sustainable Inglewood. They partnered with Northwestern University's Law Clinic, and they were able to disrupt the expansion of a freight yard by a local rail company that was trying to expand by using tax dollars from the city and buy up, you know, local homes for diminished rates and not provide any, you know, kind of initiatives to community members. So they were able to disrupt this expansion and forced an agreement between the rail company and residents that required pollution control equipment on 36 trucks. They required them to install clean engines or diesel filters on their lift equipment because they were very, very concerned not only about noise pollution, but air pollution that was increasing in their community. And they also required that the company provide $2 million towards neighborhood programming, right? So they said, we're not gonna keep it real to get this done, right? We don't have the legal expertise to really understand this, and we need to talk to local environmentalists to know what kinds of things we can ask for. And so they did, but they also are not interested in perpetuating poverty narratives of poverty, right? And pathologizing poverty. And so then when we think, go ahead.
Oh, so I enjoy this this pendulum or this continuum between this growth-based asset model and the asset-based model of development, i.e. either poverty pimping or keeping it real, but instead all acts somewhere falling somewhere between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we see this, I provided a million and one examples, not really right in the book, but just to really drive home what this means, right? So previously I mentioned this park in Little Village that Alvejo were working on. So what they ended up doing, again, because they're trying to figure out how to get real goals and real, you know, tangible things for community members in saying, we're going to take on this park initiative. They realized that 170 residents' homes, right, are the land's contaminated. Pollutants had leached into their homes when the basements would flood or their yards would flood. People would get rashes. They were terrified about, you know, what this means. And this had been going on for well over a decade. So rather than saying, again, you know, we're going to either trust the process or all throw up our hands, we don't know what to do, they're like, okay, we're going to fix this because this is an issue in our community. We're going to make sure it's addressed. We've tried contacting the EPA. They are doing nothing about it. We've tried contacting the city. They're doing nothing about it. So that means we have to collectively organize, tap into our networks, be strategic, and get this thing addressed, which they were then able to do, right? Because they got legal representation from Sierra Club. They partnered with a variety of local and national organizations. So they're able to get, right, the land deemed as being, you know, a Superfund site, get it remediated, get the homes clean, and get that beautiful park that residents during, right, this new communities program highlighted as the most important thing that they wanted for their neighborhood because they didn't have enough green space. This grassroots organization that was not getting support from the city, not getting support from LISC, not getting support from the new communities program was able to get that to happen because they were strategic and smart and tapped into those networks, right? And they were able to organize residents in this way.
This has all been great. Unfortunately, we're at that point in the interview where I have to, you know, ask this last dying question that I have. What are you working on now, Dr. Gonzalez? Where is this research taking you to your next study?
Yeah, thank you. So I just wrapped up a project primarily because of COVID in rural, kind of small rural deindustrialized towns that looks at the role. Part of what emerged in doing the work in Chicago was that the role of narrative was really influential and kind of leading some of local policy. So I looked at what that meant in kind of rural America, particularly in rural America with growing Black and Latina or X communities. And I am just now starting 3 months in a new project. And it's the beginning of what I'm considering is probably going to be a 5-year project that looks at the various ways that Black and Brown communities engage in leisure and public forms of playfulness as a way of building community and social cohesion and kind of reclaiming public space in a variety of interesting ways. I've been wanting to start this project for the past 5 years, and I'm excited that I've finally been able to start it. And so far, it's been a lot of fun. I'm happy that I'm now looking at not only you know, how people respond to kind of, you know, inherently racist policies, but also in kind of really interesting and meaningful ways, but also how they bring joy to their lives and playfulness and engage in leisure. So I'm kind of shifting into this new direction, which is super fun.
Are you going back to Chicago for that study or?
No, I have decided to root it in Massachusetts. I'm in Massachusetts now. So as an ethnographer, it makes it a little bit easier. But I've started doing work in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is a growing predominantly Dominican and Puerto Rican community with some, you know, there's also historic, you know, kind of white worker community that was tied to the mills. There's some, you know, Central American and Mexican American community there as well. And also a small growing Black, both African-American and African community, then also Afro-Latinx community as well. So that's where we've started. I will probably, for now, keep it in Massachusetts. But the seed of this, similar to the previous project, the seed of this was really planted in just doing the work in Chicago, because a lot of what activists were doing there was, you know, it was a lot of really good, hard, difficult work. And they still found ways to bring joy and happiness and playfulness into a lot of what they were doing. And it reminded me that not all of this work is as serious and depressing as it seems like it is.
Well, that's what I enjoy most about research, is the fact that doing the research almost paves the path to the next project.
Yes, absolutely. It's what it should do, right? It should be get more and more questions.
And there's always more questions than answers, at least for a sociologist.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you again for your time. This is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. I hope to talk to you soon, Dr. Gonzalez.
Thank you so much.